Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today is Brian Hoagley, managing partner of SideChannel. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. This is great. It's nice to get out of the house, get in front of some people, get talking about this. And thanks for inviting me into your studio. We were just talking about it, but it's beautiful. You got a great setup.
Well, thank you very much. We put a lot of work into it during the move.
Yeah, it shows. Now it's solid construction. No one can see this. Well, you might be able to on the videos, but this is impressive.
Well, we're going into our fourth season, which we're happy to have you a part of.
Nice.
And, you know, wanted to put a little bit behind it. So, you know, incremental improvements, point releases.
There you go. I love it. I love it.
So can you tell me a bit about what initially got you excited about technology, like way back when you were a kid?
Yeah, I started when, so we're thinking mid-80s, about 7-8 years old. My uncle, who long history of working on really interesting things. He worked on the guidance system for the SR-71. He went on to go build New York State's entire OTB system. When he retired, they replaced him with like five people. But before all of that, I think post SR-71 time, he came to my dad with this PC clone and was like, give this to Brian, this is the future. And my dad was like, the thing that we use in the office? He's like, yeah, no, trust me. Kids are going to gravitate towards this. This is the future of how the world is going to work with technology. My Uncle Fred was an amazingly smart man for what he worked on. And I credit him for getting into tech and getting interested in computers. So went full in. I mean, immersed myself. So geeky little kid growing up in New Jersey, go outside when you can. But as an introvert, believe it or not, I started out my life as an introvert. It wasn't until later that I kind of pushed myself to become extroverted. It was all about a 386. Like that was my life. And then I learned COBOL programming in the late 80s, started just kind of reading any books I could and just working on the x86 platform and getting to understand DOS and then Windows and operating systems and dialing up to BBSs and getting into trouble. And that was the beginning stages of it all. And then, you know, fast forward through growing up and it was a snowball. I just couldn't get enough of it. And it's the one thing that I know. I've just always known it's the one thing kind of got good at and actually enjoy.
Then you spent some time with the DoD after that?
Yeah. So post high school, worked in the industry for a little while, didn't go to college, and decided that when I did go to school, I needed to pay for it. So joined the Army, spent some time in uniform as a reservist while I was trying to finish college and did some really fun and interesting things there. And then as my now wife and I, who had met in school, decided what we were going to go do with our lives, we had a couple different opportunities. I had an opportunity to be one of the first employees at Rapid7 back in early 2000s, mid-2000s, when I was graduating, so around 05, 06. But we basically said, yeah, we've lived in the Northeast long enough. We don't want to go to Boston again. Let's go take the job in D.C. So then we moved to D.C. and it was just another snowball of just, you got into the circle of work and it was just one agency after another of working for. And it's interesting when you're good at something, people recognize it, which I love because I hate having to go out and being like, this is why you should come hire me. I want my work to kind of speak for itself. And that's what happened when I was down in D.C. I was working on one program for a department within the DoD. Another agency would pick me up and say, hey, we want you to come do that now. And it just grew and grew and grew. I ended up working for Military Health as their enterprise architect. So I had petabytes of servicemen and women's health records to have to maintain and manage as an enterprise architect and choreograph, if you will, across multiple different classification levels. So you kind of wonder why would healthcare be classified in the DoD? You know, if you or Andrew here in the United States, but if you go across to somewhere else and you have to be Bob and Bob goes to the doctor, how do we correlate that Bob's records are connected with Andrew's records so that when Andrew comes back to the United States, he's not misdiagnosed or given something that Bob was given? So there's ways that you have to kind of manage different tiering of data, but you can't give up that Bob is Andrew or Andrew is Bob. So there was that. I did a little time with, that sounds wrong, but I spent some time within the intelligence community itself and had a phenomenal opportunity to work on some really great programs for national security, which I'm quite proud of. And then ended up getting picked up to lead a major component of the cybersecurity program for the entire Pentagon.
Since then, what have you been up to?
Yeah, so I ended up getting scooped up and recruited in 2015 to go work for the Hanover Insurance Group. At the time, it was a Fortune 500, kind of on the cusp of a Fortune 500 insurance company, or a holding company, owned a number of different underlying companies and different names. And they were looking for their first CISO at a vice president level. And then in 2019, left that organization to start SideChannel full time, which is a company that my previous co-founder and I had started back in 2017 as a side hustle to really help small, mid-sized businesses get access to actual security advice and guidance. I mean, when I looked at vendors as a CISO, my vendors didn't have somebody like me to talk to. And that scares me as somebody who relies on my vendors to provide services. So we've focused the company on just providing services to the underserved, if you will. It's interesting. And that was the focus, was bringing people who have actually been CISOs into the room to help steer the security programs or building them even from scratch for organizations that need it, but couldn't afford a full-time one. And yeah, it's been a great journey. We've been doing that since 2019 full-time. Went really all in on it. And we've grown tremendously. And I'm incredibly happy with the success and the type of work and the clients that we have. It's great having done the corporate gig to now go work with smaller organizations who just desperately wanted to go do the right thing and will do the right thing within days and weeks, not months and quarters. Nothing wrong with larger corporations, but those timelines are long and they get kind of boring after a little while because you're like, man, this ship is just not moving.
It's like turning a battleship.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, you work for a startup with VC-backed funding or somebody who's got a PE behind them and they're at Series A. They're like, we want to go do the right thing and we want to go do it now. Sign me up. I love those opportunities. And I've got a team of guys who are all former CISOs who wanted to now go do the same thing. And it's just a lot of fun. And I think we're bringing a lot of value to companies that otherwise just would not get access to this type of expertise.
From a demand perspective, we had talked with Mark Carberry on a previous episode of Underserved.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he talked about how so many big companies are pushing these responsibilities down to their vendors and saying, you need to be at least this good at having your security. You need to have the basics, a catalog of what your exposure is, right, and a plan. And so that's what you're helping the smaller and mid-sized companies do?
Yeah, exactly. We're seeing our customers get kind of hit over the head by a couple different things. Either their board is demanding them to talk about their security posture and they can't because they don't have anybody to do it. It's a founder, it's a CTO, maybe it's a slightly larger 100, 200 person organization who's got a CIO, but hasn't really ever focused on security. So the board's asking about it. Regulators are demanding it. We work with a lot of health tech companies and other tech startups who are going into these great spaces with really innovative ideas, but highly regulated. And they're sitting there going, where do we start with? What are we supposed to meet? And realistically, which are the things that we should start with within that regulation? We obviously have to do everything, but we can't do everything day one. So we work with them. And then the last one is customers. Yeah, and it's this downstream push from the larger organizations who are, I would even say, and we see some unrealistic expectations being set by larger organizations. It's as if they think that the vendor has the same resources they do to address these security controls. And it's just not the case. So we step in and are able to really shepherd and control the narrative of the security program for our client to the larger client and really just make them feel comfortable. Honestly, at the end of the day, any CISO at a larger organization just wants to hear from their vendor that they are not a risk that they should be concerned about. And checking a box on an Excel spreadsheet of the controls they're doing or not doing doesn't do that. Getting on the phone and talking to that CISO does. And walking them through, look, we're not perfect. I don't know why you expected we were, but here's where we're not perfect. And this is what we're going to do about it. Is that inside your risk tolerance? And any CISO with their salt at a larger organization should come to that conversation and say, yeah, good. Somebody's doing something about what's going on. You're definitely hitting the critical areas that I should be concerned about. The medium risks, the low risks. Okay, sounds like you got it under control. I should check back in a year. If they're like a really key vendor, let's maybe talk quarterly. So what we're able to do is just step in and fill that role. But you don't need a full-time CISO at a small organization or a mid-sized organization to do that. We're not there to shape culture and be a part of the executive team. We're there to build a security program for you. So we're there when you need us. We're not when you don't.
I imagine step one is like doing an assessment and figuring out where you're at. I think you developed some tools around that.
Yeah, we did. So internally, we had built a tool just for us as consulting. The first thing a CISO does is assess an organization, right? What am I working with? Where are the gaps? Is it regulators, is it customers, is it board who's demanding an output and a response? So the consulting view is very just manually intensive. It takes a lot of time. I have to sit down and schedule time with you. And now it's 2 man hours are going into asking questions and answering questions. So 2 years ago, I just thought this is ridiculous. But GRC tools as they exist today are onerous. You need a full-time person behind them and things like that. And it just takes too much and it's costly. So I thought, well, what are the fun little things out of GRC tools that we do need that I like to use? How can we make this scalable? So we built a little platform to just use as a consulting tool to basically help us just do data collection on all the controls of what an organization is doing, make it in a way that they can actually answer it. So you can do it on your time. Now, it's not 2 man hours. It's whenever you have time and you find the right people to answer the questions on your side of the organization, put the information in. Then when you're ready, then we can analyze it. And then from there, it basically just kind of snowballed. So we spun out the software as its own company. It's called RealCISO.io. And it now exists for anybody to access, not just for us to use. So we're seeing consultants use it with their clients because it just streamlines the data gathering and the evidence collection and auto-generate reports against a number of different frameworks and standards. And its goal is for an informed, not necessarily a well-informed or an expert, an informed employee or user at any organization, small business, medium-sized business, to be able to answer the questions and go through it. So it's built a lot on the CIS Top 20, the controls, which is a great organization that stands behind former SANS Top 20 controls and all that. It's built on that, but it's easy to use. And because it's so easy to use, now we're seeing enterprises start to use it. And CISOs are actually starting to use it to just go, hey, I don't need a GRC tool. I just need to do a risk assessment and kind of know what I'm working with. Like, exactly. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. I don't know why I signed up to run 2 companies, but that's where we are right now. And it's exciting. And it's exciting to help people realize that they don't need a lot to just get started, to start making their organization more secure. Because I will tell you, through clients and prospective clients we talk to, some of these people scare me a little bit that they don't already have some of this stuff in place. And they're just kind of coming to the table going, I should be doing something, but I don't know what. And I'm grateful that they're coming to us. But at the same time, I'm sitting there going, I use your services. Why am I just learning this now? You know, like as a consumer, I'm sitting there kind of like, you know?
How many companies haven't come to you yet?
it's interesting. But what's great about, and I think we can be a little selective in what we're doing, we get to select our clients. And we've told people no, because we get into the conversation and you realize, oh, you just want us there for compliance. You just literally just want a CISO as a checkbox. That's not us. We're here to build a security program. Because if you're just doing a compliance play, you're probably not taking the best next steps or doing best practices. So your chances of having an issue are significantly higher. I just don't want to be associated with that. I don't want to be associated with, we're just here to check the box.
Someone who's not taking it seriously.
Exactly. So the people that bring us in, they are the founders, they are the CEOs, CFOs, or general counsel of these organizations, or they're the VC or PE behind them. So it's not like the director of IT is bringing us in to say like, hey, we got to do something about security. It's like, no, I'm coming in with the decision maker. So I get to look these people in the eye and figure out, are you serious about doing this? Because we're not just going to be here for 10 hours a month to just like, whatever. You really want to address and build a security program. You want to do the right thing. That's why you came here. And they say yes, and they're serious. We work with them.
Now, we talked a bit on the pre-call about some other vendors in the security space and kind of what some of the issues are that you see with them. But I think the listeners would be curious to hear that as well.
I think everyone's just like buzz happy on cybersecurity and everyone's trying to create everything in cyber and sell it. And you see a lot of stuff that's just like, no one should be using this, or the way that they're pitching it and marketing it is not what it does. They're really over their skis.
They seem to have trouble or not be willing to map what they're doing to actual requirements from standards. No one wants the accountability.
Yeah. So that's a big thing. Being a CISO, I take a very standard first approach to things. I don't want to come in and be like, this is Brian's magic math on how to do security. It's not on me. Like, I'm not the smartest guy in the world. So I love to use what's already established and proven. I will go to that first. It just makes sense. And that way I can blame it when it goes wrong. No, I'm just kidding. But like, you know, I can say, look, these are the standards that were put together by very, very smart people as a collection. This isn't just my opinion that's coming here. One of the things that we do, and I've just always done, is I go to the standards and, well, what controls is this product actually meeting? You know, not just like what the marketing is. If I'm following the CIS Top 20 or the NIST CSF, tell me how your product is helping me meet those, because that's the standard I'm now building this program on. So that's what I'm holding myself to. Help me figure out where you meet in that. A lot of organizations have a hard time doing that, which I find shocking, because if you're going to build any product or any security product, you should probably be looking at the standards that are accepted within the security space, and yet not a lot of folks are. I mean, there are some, but even just what we're doing with our platform, because we map in all of these vendors that we're positioning in our platform for our clients to look at to the controls. And some of these folks don't get past the first stage of just, well, tell me what controls you do. Oh, well, we got to go figure that out. What do you mean you got to go figure that out? How do you not know what your product does? It's like, oh, it's in the marketing. But don't you have sales engineers? Don't you have engineering? Don't you have anybody who's got an alignment on the actual controls that your product or service meets? No? Okay. Wow.
But we are a hot cybersecurity company.
Oh, the hottest, the greatest. AI, ML to the cloud using Bitcoin, but you can't pay us in Bitcoin. Yeah, the marketing is nuts. There's some great people out there who call it like it is too on the same thing. I won't mention them, but like, I'm glad there's more people who are going to be vocal about and honest about some of this stuff than everyone just kind of singing kumbaya on the latest IPO'd security product company that's like, oh, we got to use them. Why? Because they're awesome. But prove it. What are they mapping to? Because my board doesn't care about us using the latest and greatest or the coolest thing. They might bring it up because they heard it on the news. That's a normal practice for board members. It's like, oh, I heard about this. Are we using it? Sir, no, thank you. Board members are doing the best they can, right? This is a new space to them. Most of them barely grasp IT, let alone security. So like getting them into understand that's like the role of the CISO now, I think, is educating board members on what they should be asking and understanding about operational risk at an enterprise level. Make sure you actually know what questions you should be asking me if you're going to invite me into the room.
Yeah, they'd see stuff bubble up. They see their peers getting lambasted somewhere and they're like, hey, I don't want to be that guy.
Exactly. We had a program at Pentagon called Front Page that it was just this kind of under the radar program that we ran, not a technical program, purely just sneaker net and word of mouth. And everyone basically listened to NPR. And we made sure that if anything was on the news in the last 24 to 48 hours, one, our bosses weren't in it. Two, if anything came up that was interesting or like new, we were ready to talk about it because we knew they were listening to that on the way in. And that would be one of the first things that we get asked about. It's like, hey, I heard about this morning. What are we doing about that? Is that a risk? And we'd be already in front of it. It was like clockwork. You'd be like, oh, I can guarantee we're getting a question on this today. Bing, every time. And the same thing happens in corporate America. So you just gotta like read the news going into any board meeting and knowing like, all right, they happen every 3 months. Watch the news. What are the big things for 3 months? Because board members will take notes over that time between board meetings so that they can come into that meeting and have the questions that I don't want to say justify their existence for being at the table, right? But they want to show their involvement, their
checked
knowledge.
In.
Right. They're tied to the conversation. They know what's going on. And they're drawing a lot of that from either the NACD's documentation for board members, or they're drawing it from the news because those are their sources on this stuff, because these people are not security experts in their day job. They are presidents of companies or influential people within the community or whatever. They don't focus on cyber. So they draw on the sources that are available to them. And that's what they bring in. So you can almost, if you're actually smart about it as a CISO, quarter by quarter, you can figure out what you're going to be asked. I used to just read the NACD, the National Association of Corporate Directors handbook on cybersecurity. They publish one every year. It's great. And there are a list of questions in there that it literally says, questions that you should ask at your next audit committee meeting or your next board meeting on cybersecurity. I would just go through that and just be like, oh, let me make sure I have all the answers for all of these. I'd have that in hand. And then I'd have the last 3 months worth of news cycle that was like relevant. I'd cover every question every time.
This sounds like a third company you're going to start.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Cerence? They're the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Syrinx. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy. Aww.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Syrinx today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
Yeah, we will provide intelligence to CISOs on board preparation. Oh, I love that. I'll do a joint venture with you on that. That sounds cool. I don't think I have enough bandwidth right now to start a third one, but I mean, seriously, that's a very real time suck for CISOs is getting ready for board. There's the whole, what metrics do I show? What do I want to show that be proud of? What do I want to show to make sure that they're understanding of the risks that I'm unfortunately not proud we didn't address? That's the element that CISOs want to focus on going into a boardroom to then help the board see what it is that they want to do, to then help the board see why they need the resources and money to go do what they need. Because the board's role is not operational in the company. It's to make sure that management is doing the right thing. And if you can garner the respect and feedback and everything from board members, you got this kind of downward pressure on the CEO, CFO, like, hey, you should be giving the CISO some attention and resources to address these things because this is the stuff that we're concerned about. And we think you should be concerned about CEO. So you play your cards right, you can really have that conversation, educate them to have that work in your favor.
Now, over the course of your career, you had several different instances where you were spotting threats and helping folks figure out where their vulnerabilities were. You had some good stories about doing that in a physical sense. Was that back in the DoD days?
So that was actually before the DoD. Yeah, we used to run skits or call them skits. So as an ethical hacker, a pen tester, we'd be called in by an organization to test their security posture. And a lot of that would include physical security. So think late 90s, early 2000s. WEP hadn't been cracked yet, but that was fun when it was because that just made our jobs a heck of a lot easier. Think about sitting in a van in the middle of an office park and basically being like, which one do we want to connect to right now? So I used to be a smoker. Being a smoker was the easiest way into any building, you know, because smokers are kind of a hated group by people who are not smokers. But because of that, as a group, you usually congregate together because you know no one else likes you. So I used to, scrawny little kid, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, I would basically walk up to the group of smokers on the backside of the building that was our target and just, hey, can I get a light? You know, you start shooting the breeze with them and everything. You're having a cigarette. And then it's like, oh, you know, oh, I forgot my badge. Today's my first day. I'm starting over in accounting. No one knows anybody in accounting. You got to have a little bit of intelligence on the organization before you can start riffing with these guys to make it believable. But yeah, I would just socially engineer my way into a building and it'd be like in through the smoker's entrance, you know, and people would just be like, oh yeah, HR never gets it right on it. Yeah, you'll get your badge. Yeah, come on in. It's like, oh, cool. Yeah, I'll see you guys at lunch. Oh, yeah, great. Yeah, okay. And then boom, you're inside the building. I mean, you want to talk about how far we've come. Back in the day when you used to just be able to plug a USB in and you had the INI file on there that would just run a command once you plugged it in. Like when Microsoft wasn't by default disabling auto run, the second you get into a building, it was like, oh, this is over.
Game over.
Game over. So it's like, oh, let's just walk down the vice president row and so-and-so is not in their office. And then it's just like plug in USB, and it's just copying anything with documents on it. So the other team who I was working with, they would write all these programs. My job was to just get in there and make it happen. You go sit in the cafeteria, go sit in the bathroom, close a stall, sit there for like a couple hours. And I'd come back and make sure everything was cool, pull the USBs back out and be on my way. Usually maybe even walk out the front door. What one of our sales guys used to do to really drive the point home of what we did, we would take the USBs and we'd put them in an envelope and put it in the company's outgoing mail. And then we would walk out. So you'd walk out, you have nothing on you. So at worst case, trespassing. But remember, you're supposed to be there. So one of the other things we would do is we would have the authorization in a Ziploc bag and taped to our stomach. So in case we found ourselves in handcuffs, we could be like, just call the number that's taped to my stomach there. You'll talk to the guy, the CFO, whoever authorized us. So that was like our always get out of jail free card. Because if you didn't have that, you know, like those guys in Colorado that got nicked by coal fire or whatever that happened to. So way back in 2000s, this was happening. And I don't think a lot of people like ran across it. Anyway, USBs and all the information would go in outgoing mail. We'd leave. The final presentation and everything, it was classic. This guy would have printed out a lot of this information and put it in the outgoing mailbox. And he would rip it open and be like, you mailed us all your information. He'd like shake the envelope free and all the papers would come out just to like drive the point home. It's like, you literally sent us everything about your company. You have no physical control. This guy walked in using a cigarette and a lighter. It's like, oh man, it almost wasn't fair. We used to run skits. We'd hire very beautiful women who are actresses and want to do modeling or act. And we'd find the local IT outfit or as close to it as we could. And we'd have them walk in literally with a clipboard and a USB. And they were there to do services, whatever the IT services were.
I'm from Colorado Springs IT.
Yeah. Like guys would move cabinets for these women. And then they'd get under the desk and plug in a USB or a keylogger in a keyboard. Guys didn't know what to do. Even women would just be like, I don't know what to say. One, I'm shocked that you work for that company. I can't believe you work for an IT services company. That's incredible. And literally, they'd move things for these women and then they'd leave. And then we'd go back in at some point, either masquerade as janitors or whatever else, and capture the data and walk back out. So a lot of physical accesses that we would do. Those are the fun ones. And then eventually standards kind of increased around Microsoft and companies. So those didn't work anymore, but those are the fun ones. And it was, I mean, the old walk in with a UPS hat on and a big box and people will just hold the door for you and you can walk in. I used to walk in as a flower delivery guy and I would have a name of somebody who purposely didn't work at the company. And I'd be like, well, listen, I've got to leave these flowers with somebody. And if it was the secretary or somebody at the front, and usually these companies are kind of old school and like have a woman sitting at the front and be like, well, listen, can I just leave these flowers here with you? And no one says no to free flowers. I'd be like, hey, since I'm here, can I use your bathroom? It's like, oh yeah, it's right down that hall there. Thanks. Just walk right in. It was fun. I did not know I had that in me when I started doing that work. Again, years earlier, I was this introvert working on computers, but I started doing physical security work for these guys who were doing really hardcore, cool stuff. I mean, these guys were either in the van trying to get in through the wireless, or they were at the office trying to break in through the front door. And here I am trying to like get my way up to doing that type of work. And I'm the one who's smoking cigarettes with the other guys trying to break in. That's how I tried to earn my jobs. And it was a good gig. It was fun.
Well, there's an awful lot of emphasis on hardening the cyber side, the internet facing, the network touching parts of a company, but humans tend to be the weakest link.
Yeah, just go after them. I mean, the rule when you're doing that type of work is the CEO's kids are not off limits. That's the rules you abide by, which basically means there are no rules to it, unless the company bringing you in is very clear on, hey, do not do X, Y, and Z. But think about it. Attackers, they're not playing by rules. Bad guys don't have rules to play by. And they're actually at a super advantage because they don't have rules to play by. And this is a business for them with a real ROI. These types of organizations that we're kind of all up against as defenders, I don't think most people appreciate how much of a business op it is for them. They have a payroll. They have financing. They have HR departments. Their employees go on vacation. There were times in some places I worked where you could tell when the bad guys were on vacation because you would see activity go down. It was always interesting. Back in the day, the week or two right after Black Hat DEF CON, the DoD usually saw an increase in attacks. Why? Because everybody came back from the conference with all these cool new things to go try out. It's the same thing that the intelligence community can do around and sees around physical attacks in the Middle East, right? You know, if you had Muslim extremists doing things, they observed Ramadan, you would see physical attacks go down during that time. The same thing happens in cyberspace. The same thing happens too when you start building out defensive programs. I think people overlook the physical access components, right? I think there's probably people who'll be like, oh yeah, duh, there's always that. But you wouldn't believe how many people don't do this. If I can pull in badge data as to when you came into the building and correlate it with VPN access data, like I saw you just badge in, but you're also logging in from South Dakota. That's not right. That should be a yellow flag. Do you know people don't do that? It's so simple. It's like, why don't you have access to badge data? Why don't you have access to VPN data? Correlate those things. You know, the whole superhuman, super travel thing. It's like, I just saw you log in from California and from the Ukraine. Like, that should be a yellow flag. And I always kind of just talk about these things as yellow flags. I think everyone's always honed in on red flags. Like, that's the obvious stuff. Okay. Yellow flags, I think, are really where cybersecurity is really interesting, is where you can start being like, it's not entirely sure that that's wrong, but I don't feel right about what I just saw. So that's a yellow flag. What am I seeing that should give me concern, but isn't a complete 100% aha. Those are the areas where really good attackers are operating, because the second you kind of let up on what you're doing, play goes to the defender. It's the defender's game now. So when you're trying to run low and slow, you're trying to not make a lot of noise, you're trying to run under the radar, you can't expect to be seeing red flags. If you do, those aren't very good attackers, right? Then they're not going to be around for very long. And their ROI goes down significantly because, again, massive amounts of resources going into trying to do these things. So you got to look for the yellow flags. And I think people just kind of discount it and just go for like the obvious stuff.
You mentioned a yellow flag you spotted with the Cyrillic keyboard showing up in RDP.
Yeah. So one of the things that was interesting early on, you could tell when Russians were trying to access things because the keyboard mapping on a computer is set differently depending on what your native language is and what you select when you set up the operating system. So we would see in RDP sessions, back when people could actually have RDP running and open to the internet, you would see the keyboard logon type, the mappings indicative of someone who came out of either the Eastern Bloc or Russia, because that would have been their keyboard mapping and character set.
Yeah.
So nobody in the US should be using that. So that should have been an obvious, like, oh, well, why is this happening? Same thing with Chinese or Asian letter keyboard mappings as well. And it was interesting because after a while that stopped because those guys and girls got smart to it. But early on, I think that's a really useful thing to remember and to look for, because those types of flags are probably still happening now. And if we can know about them and discern them, we can use them until they're no longer useful. And then the attackers get smart. But there's no reason we as defenders can't try to be innovative and smart in figuring these things out, just like attackers are doing. It's a cat and mouse game, right?
You mentioned a couple famous, or maybe more accurately, infamous folks from Lagos, Nigeria, a couple of brothers who were running scams.
Yeah. So Lagos has obviously the whole Nigerian scam thing, but beyond that, a massive amount of phishing that comes out of Lagos. And it can actually be tied to two different groups. One is a pair of brothers that runs around and moves around different internet cafes to launch and do their operations. And they're actually doing quite well. The other major operation there is actually a well-funded organized syndicate, criminal syndicate of some sort, that has some type of operation and backing, and no one's really messing with them, either from the government or whatever. They're allowed to be what they're doing. And both of them are just killing it with the whole phishing thing. But yeah, we could track and see phishing attempts coming in from Lagos or tied back to Lagos. And again, some of these yellow flags about where things were coming from, maybe not even where it was coming from, but where they were trying to get data to go to. A couple years ago, people really made an effort to just not show where they were actually from. So they're trying to do hops through other different places.
VPN.
Yeah. I feel like in the last 5 years, some people are just like, whatever, I don't care.
YOLO.
Yep. Yep. You know it's me. It's coming right out
I'm
of Lagos.
Coming right at you.
Yep. What are you going to do about it, right? It's almost like they're just thumbing their nose at everyone. Same thing with the operations side. We really see it get interesting is the Eastern Bloc. This was true years ago when I saw what was happening with this. You had these kids coming out of these really great computer science programs and not getting jobs. Eastern Europe, you know, there wasn't a lot of work. But then you've got these ex-KGB, ex-Stasi guys who know how to run teams and motivate people and who don't really care what they're doing, but they want to run some type of an enterprise. And they might have some backing from Moscow on allowing them to probably do what they're doing and operate wherever it is they are operating, probably so long as Moscow gets a taste. So now you got these ex-KGB Stasi guys, and they can run teams. And you got all these Eastern European kids.
Unemployed. CS grads.
Boom. Right? What do you got? You've got a cybercrime family, right? Now at your fingertips. And the early days of that were exactly that. Where do these folks come from? Boom. Intelligence tells you, comes back. This is how they came to be. That is incredible. Why aren't we doing that in the US? But, you know, for good. So I think you see kind of like out of Russia as a threat, you've got the military threat, but then you've got this kind of criminal enterprise threat that's given some level of cover to operate versus China, which is very militaristic and national in its approach and less so criminal. I mean, there's probably criminal elements. I'm not attuned to it. I just know when people are like, well, what about Russia and China? It's like, well, they're kind of different. They're going after different things. And same thing with North Korea. They're kind of going after different things. Everybody has their different motivations and where these groups come from. And then, like you said, like the African groups out of Lagos and some of the other countries that just, they're allowed to exist. I think in the US, FBI and Department of Justice does a good job or bad job, but they're at least bent on shutting that kind of thing down from happening here is criminal elements within the US, and they flex their jurisdiction appropriately. I don't think a lot of other countries do that if it's happening. And I think it's probably because there's the ability for that government to get a kickback. It's like, oh, well, if you're going to pay me to like just ignore you, sure, keep filling the coffers.
The story you told me there reminded me of a show we've been watching, National Geographic Trafficked, with Mariana Van Celler.
Ooh.
She's a Portuguese journalist. She also speaks very good English and mm-hmm. Spanish, and ends up going all over the place and just showing the underbelly of all these criminal operations, whether it's cocaine or heroin. And one show struck me as odd. It was called The Game, and it's about how there's all these folks in Jamaica who used to work for call centers and got very good at conversing over the phone and calling into the United States, and now are calling in and scamming folks out of money. And it's become so prevalent that, like you said, there's organized businesses that have all these people running the game, kicking money up, bribing of officials. It's become like a super successful enterprise for them. And there's even now songs about it.
Oh, yeah.
There's like these dub songs Nice. Where people are talking about the game and
Right.
how much money they're making scamming people. And it seems like they're going after the retail consumer, if you will.
Sure.
You know, like the lonely person sitting at home in the Midwest or whatever. But I'm sure it's only a matter of time before they set their sights on corporations as well.
It will be a matter of time, because like anything, once you figure out something works and it can make you money, you're going to figure out how to scale it. I mean, think back to the Nigerian scams and phishing and everything back in the 90s as it started. We're seeing those same groups just grown up and matured like any other good business. As you mature, you get better. You reinvest in yourself. You figure out new revenue streams. Now, this is the thing that still kills me for most folks I talk to, and even at conferences with other CISOs. It's like, guys, I can't stress this enough. There is an ROI in a business happening on the other side that is attacking you. The second that you realize you are in a competition with another business for your own money or data, you need to understand that. And most people just, I don't know why, are still stuck in this like kid in his mom's basement thinking, even though they know and have heard the stories of, well, Russia did this and China did that and North Koreans did this and this criminal group and that criminal group. There's still this mentality of diminishing the attacker. It's Sun Tzu, right? Like the second you underestimate your adversary, you've lost. Right. Yeah. They've won, you've lost. And most businesses are doing this around cyber risk. And what really strikes me is I talk to really smart, very well-positioned, established CEOs, CFOs who understand how to address this from a business to legitimate business standpoint of why and how they can win and beat their competition. But they can't think about this from an adversarial standpoint when it comes to a risk like cybersecurity. It's almost like shut down. They don't apply everything else they know about how business works to this. I think, honestly, once you kind of accept it, this is happening. This is how they operate. This is what we're up against. You take it a little bit more seriously, and you actually now start figuring out, how do I better position my actual resources to shut this down? And it keeps it fresh. And it's no longer just this thing that we had to just do and we got firewalls, we're good. No, that was good back in the 90s. And even then, it wasn't that great. You still need to do more. You need to stay on top of it. What part of your business do you just kind of set and forget and expect it's going to keep growing? No, you got to keep nurturing it. You got to keep building it. I don't think it's going to change enough, but I really wish it would. I really wish people would just kind of acknowledge that there's an ROI on the other side of this.
I think it's just such a scary proposition that there's some willful denial.
All right. The whole people want to believe people are good. No one's going to do this, right? And people are always aghast at like, somebody broke into my neighbor's house. I can't believe that happened here. It could happen anywhere. It just happened to happen to your neighbor. You're lucky it didn't happen to you. But now you're going to start locking your doors for 6 months. And then you're going to stop locking your doors again. People can't transcend that to the logical plane, which is where cybersecurity operates. Physical security, it's hard enough for you to kind of get over that, like, oh, bad people are going to do bad things. You still kind of believe, not in my neighborhood. I live here, or I work there. It's not going to happen where I am. Everyone's connected to the internet. So no one has that understanding that there is no good place on the internet. You live in a bad place. all the time.
The whole internet is a bad neighborhood.
It is, right? I mean, honestly, go to a bad neighborhood. Those people lock their doors. They have situational awareness. They don't make themselves a victim. They walk tall. They know how to hold themselves. They don't boast. No high profiling when you're far from home. Most devs said that. You don't boast about what you're doing. So when you're in any place, you hold yourself a certain way. You protect your family. You protect your business. You know what to do if you live in a bad neighborhood. In a good neighborhood, less so, because you believe you live in a good neighborhood. Yeah. The internet is a bad neighborhood.
All right, Brian. So if you were to sum it up for folks that are trying to just get a handle on this giant thing that is wrapping their heads around security and why do I even need a CISO, what would you say to them?
I cannot defend what I don't know exists. If you don't have at the very minimum an asset inventory of your software and hardware, you're done. You cannot protect what you don't know about. So fundamentals, start with an inventory. Get a grasp on what you actually have in your organization and own, and then you can start figuring out where to put the right protections. I feel like so many people just skip that step because they think it's too hard, too arduous, whatever, but it pays dividends in the long run if you can actually get down, start on paper, a bar napkin, a whiteboard, it doesn't matter. Just get down what you actually have to protect inside of your organization. Start with what you own.
Well, thank you very much for coming down and appearing on Underserved.
Thank you so much. This is great. I love being out here. This is probably one of the most phenomenal things I've done in a year. So thank you so much for grabbing me out of my house and inviting me in. This has been a great discussion, and I look forward to more.
Well, we appreciate you being here, and we'll talk to everyone on the next episode of Underserved.